Hello and welcome to the Risk Map podcast for the second half of March 2015, brought to you by Control Risks, the global political integrity and security risk consultancy. In New York, I'm Michael Moran, Managing Director for Global Risk Analysis. Welcome to the podcast.
And in London, I'm Charles Hecker, Control Risks Global Head of Research. In this edition, we'll look at the corruption scandal dogging Brazil's state oil giant Petrobras. We examine U.S.-Afghan relations ahead of a visit to Washington by new President Ashraf Ghani, but we start this week in Venezuela, where a difficult situation has grown worse in the face of low global oil prices.
Of all the major OPEC oil producers, none has suffered a harsher blow from low oil prices than Venezuela. With revenue shortfalls feeding economic instability, political unrest, an echo of last summer's street riots, has also resumed, and it has spawned a crackdown on dissent by the government of President Nicolas Maduro. In early March, the U.S. placed sanctions on the country, and another devaluation of Venezuela's currency has added to the country's woes. I spoke to Oliver Wack, Control Risks Analyst for Venezuela.
It looks like things are taking a turn for the worse in Venezuela. So on 9th March, the U.S. government announced a new round of sanctions against senior government officials, including high-ranking members of the armed forces, the National Guard, the intelligence service, and one public prosecutor. This was followed very swiftly by accusations by President Maduro that the U.S. was meddling in Venezuelan affairs. He accused President Obama of imperialism and announced that he was going to ask the National Assembly for an enabling law, granting him decree powers to combat the threat of U.S. imperialism. Now, the immediate impact of that is probably going to be limited, as we saw following the arrest of Caracas Metropolitan Mayor Ledezma in mid-February. There seems to be very little stomach within the opposition to go back onto the streets and to stage large-scale riots. We do think that there will be some protesting by student groups, by some more extreme members of the opposition, but in the very short term, the fallout will be limited. The problem is that this enabling law comes in a context in which the government is facing very low approval ratings, in fact, the lowest since the beginning of Chavismo in 1999. The government is also looking at legislative elections later in the year, and the question now is whether the enabling law could be used to either bypass those elections completely or to rule without the National Assembly in case the government loses the elections. And I think in either case, we would see very large-scale protests break out. We would see the opposition going onto the streets, and we would likely see violence in the context of those protests. This is obviously exacerbated by the fact that the government recently passed a decree authorizing the armed forces to use lethal force against protesters. The problem there is that we're then facing likely a new round of sanctions as the human rights situation deteriorates, and it appears that we're on a downward spiral for Venezuela over the next year or two.
So, Oliver, there are many companies exposed here, but what is the reality there? I mean, I would think the government would be eager not to see an exodus right now of companies that are providing basic services and keeping the economy afloat.
Absolutely. So the question now is whether the government will retaliate against private sector interests following the first round of sanctions and then, as I said, likely new sanctions as the situation deteriorates. And it really depends on the extent to which protests happen, on the extent to which the government needs to take populist measures like expropriations and the likes to shore up its public support. For the moment, I think the government is well aware that expropriations lead to less efficiency, and the last thing it needs is to reduce the already very low income of dollars into the economy, especially given the low oil prices. What we will likely continue to see is the government taking measures such as increasing the inspections under price control legislation, temporary occupations of retail stores, especially when they're found guilty of violating price controls, and potentially even the arrests of leading executives of companies accused of violating price controls. I think the main impact that the new round of sanctions that the current situation has for companies is the compliance risk associated with the sanctions, specifically if we consider that they're likely to be broadened out and include other members of the government. As of today, many companies have close relationships with the leading figures in the government because you need those to be able to do business. But as the U.S. widens its net of sanctions and other people fall under those, it'll be more difficult for companies that have those links to leading officials accused of human rights violations.
Thanks, Oliver. That's Oliver Wack speaking to us from Bogota.
Afghanistan's new president, Ashraf Ghani, pays his first visit to Washington on 24 March, and he's got a lot on his wish list. With the U.S.-led international intervention winding down, the new president hopes to slow the pace of the drawdown and win a commitment for aid stretching beyond the 2016 deadline for a pullout. Joining us from London is Control Risk's senior consultant and Afghan expert, Huma Yusuf.
So, Huma, what is Ghani hoping to get from this visit?
I think his main priority on this first visit is to just rehabilitate the relationship between Afghanistan and the United States, which was really damaged during the tenure of former President Hamid Karzai. Relations between Washington and Kabul have been toxic under Karzai, and the main goal for this first visit is to just get the conversation started again. And the main focus of that conversation will be to talk about slowing the pace of U.S. troop withdrawal from Afghanistan, which right now is scheduled to be completed at the end of 2016, but Ghani is looking to push that deadline.
There's been some talk here since Ashton Carter took over as defense secretary that indeed he is in sync with that thinking. No one's talking about changing the deadline of U.S. troops leaving Afghanistan in Washington, but they are talking about perhaps the pace of actions going on in Afghanistan. I know U.S. troops are far less active now than they were. How does that sync with what the president is trying to do inside Afghanistan?
The Afghan Taliban have really taken advantage of the drawdown of international troops to have a resurgence. They are moving from the southern and eastern provinces, which have historically been their home base, and successfully carrying out high-profile and big-impact attacks in the central provinces and certainly in the capital, Kabul. Ashraf Ghani is looking very much to have as much U.S. support for the Afghan National Security Forces as long as possible. And this is key because the ANSF, the Afghan National Security Forces, are facing the brunt of the Taliban onslaught at the moment. They have the highest rates of attrition that they've had since 2011. The casualty rates are soaring. They've been repeatedly described as unsustainable. And I think that the hope, though, the actual and ultimate hope, is to sort of use the next year and a half to convince the U.S. to even prolong its presence beyond 2016. And the fear is that if drawdown happens gradually, as it has been planned, that it will be difficult for the U.S. to send troops back in, but that if they don't leave in the next 18 months or so, that it might be easier to prolong their presence.
Let's look at the near-end neighborhood. Ghani seems to be trying to patch things up with Pakistan. That has kind of ambiguous echoes in the United States. What is the strategy there from the Afghan standpoint?
Ghani is off the mind, as Pakistan is as well, that the only long-term solution to the conflict in Afghanistan is some sort of political dialogue and ultimate negotiation with the Afghan Taliban and their inclusion in the political process in Afghanistan. This has been the main ask from Pakistan for the last 30 years. They feel that there needs to be a strong Pashtun bloc in the government in Kabul. And Ghani wants to start that process, and he knows that it cannot happen without the Pakistan military's intervention and support and facilitation. So one of the things that Ghani is looking to do is to get the U.S. back on board with this idea of keeping Pakistan centrally included in the dialogue with the Afghan Taliban. It's something that the U.S. has been stepping away from while bilateral relations between Washington and Islamabad have soured over the last few years, but it's something that all parties are going to have to reconcile with if there's going to be progress on the negotiations front.
Huma, thank you very much.
And now to Brazil. In March 2014, Brazil's federal police began an investigation known as Operation Car Wash into alleged acts of corruption involving the national oil company Petrobras. Prosecutors say a group of 20 companies formed a cartel in order to unfairly obtain Petrobras contracts between 2004 and 2012.
Well, in late February, for the first time, prosecutors began naming the names of senior Brazilian politicians, too. Here to discuss the fallout is our Sao Paulo-based Brazil analyst, Tomas Favaro. Tomas, what are these politicians accused of?
Well, the prosecutor's office found preliminary evidence of the involvement of at least 34 serving politicians in this corruption scandal. And these are mainly federal deputies and senators, and includes the speakers of both houses. Now, these politicians are accused of having appointed their associates to senior posts at Petrobras to oversee the whole corruption scheme. And in return, they demanded bribes of around 1% of the value of each contract that Petrobras signed with the cartel. And so far, there's no indication that President Dilma Rousseff is directly involved in the scheme, but it certainly increases the pressure on her, not least because she was a member of the company's board during the time that the irregularities allegedly took place.
This obviously has implications for companies doing business in Brazil, those who are already there, those who may be thinking of getting in. So what should these companies be thinking of this?
I think, first of all, the scandal is quite indicative of the persistent corruption risks in Brazil, in both the public and the private sector. Companies that are operating or maybe willing to operate in Brazil should really think about the best way to implement their local compliance programs, include, let's say, reputational assessments in the selection of their business partners, think about periodic vetting of subcontractors. There's a range of tools available to reduce the exposure to these corruption risks in Brazil. And the precedent from a range of companies that are operating in the country suggests that some of these can actually be quite effective and successful.
All right, Tomas, thank you very much.
Thanks, Mike. Before we sign off, a few other items of interest in the coming 2 weeks. On Tuesday, the 17th of March, snap parliamentary elections are held in Israel with incumbent Benjamin Netanyahu neck and neck with his rivals in latest polling. On Thursday, the 19th of March, Thailand's Supreme Court is scheduled to decide whether to take up the corruption case against former Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawatra. On Sunday, the 22nd of March, Egypt holds the first of a two-round parliamentary election. And finally, on Saturday, the 28th of March, Nigeria's closely fought and once-delayed presidential elections will be held. The perils of corruption in Nigeria are the topic of our webcast, The Dialogue, now available on our website, www.controlrisks.com. The Dialogue features Control Risk CEO Richard Fenning and Tom Griffin, our Managing Director for West Africa. The conversation also features Uche Orji, the CEO and Managing Director of the Nigerian Sovereign Investment Authority, the NSIA.
Thanks. That's it for this edition. We hope you enjoyed the latest Risk Map podcast produced by Control Risks, the global political integrity and security risk consultancy. Risk Map podcast is available twice a month on iTunes or via the Control Risks website. For now, this is Michael Moran from New York signing off.
And in London, on behalf of my colleagues in 36 offices around the world, this is Charles Hecker saying thank you for listening, and until next time, goodbye.